If you think you can't go from politics to the divine, Carol Gold and Steve Clark are about to take you above the fray. The only agenda here is to empower you to think for yourself, ask more questions, and trust your own truth. So now, the combination talk radio has been missing. Until now, Carol Gold and Steve Clark taking you above the fray.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Above the Fray. I'm Carol Gold, and our number here is 914-803-4522 if you want to get in on the discussion. Welcoming my co-host to the show tonight. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Carol.
Steve, let's see now. There's so much. Where do we begin? Let's talk about what happened yesterday. There were three allegedly separate cyber attacks. There were three alleged technical difficulties that happened yesterday. One was to United Airlines, one was to the New York Stock Exchange, and one was to the Wall Street Journal. And the one shut down the exchange for several hours. And what we're told is that there are three isolated incidents, that they weren't terror attacks in any way, even though the night before the hacker group Anonymous tweeted that it might be a bad day for the stock exchange tomorrow. So, as often happens, Steve, the narrative is what they would like us to believe. And when I say they, I mean the federal government. I find it virtually impossible to believe that there were three technical failures to the point where trading was interrupted, where all planes were interrupted, where actually all United flights were canceled. And I don't know what happened to the Wall Street Journal. Maybe you do, Steve. But the point is that there's a new kind of warfare, and we've known about it. We've known it's coming. And one of the analysis I heard today, Steve, was I heard a somewhat credible radio host say that there's no way those were cyber attacks, because if they were, they never would have been so minor. And the way I see it is they're just building up to the big one. They're playing games, amusing their own egos to show what they can do. But there is an inevitable, not just hack, but there is an eventual shutdown, either of, in my opinion, either of the internet or of our electrical grid or of some technology, our banking system, ATMs, that they're just toying with us at this point, the way a cat toys with a mouse. Steve, what do you think about yesterday?
Yeah, the thing that I would just say is it was just a series of, I would say, unrelated events. And if you look at it, you know, after the fact, I think it becomes a very interesting picture. The first was the shutdown of the stock market. And, you know, in and of itself, all stock markets have a glitch, and so at times, and so they get shut down. So I thought that was unusual. But then, you know, I just started looking at different things. I saw during the day that the Drudge Report was shut down. Not the Drudge Report, Wall Street Journal was shut down. Another site that I frequent, Zero Hedge, had technical difficulties as well. Zero Hedge is a website primarily for the financial community that kind of reports on countercultural issues that the mainstream media doesn't pick up. But it's really quite a good site for getting, you know, different types of information the market does not report on. Then there was, at the same time, obviously, that the story that United Airlines had a technical glitch with their airline. And it reminded me of a magazine article from, I'd say about 6 months ago on Wired magazine, that they were talking about just especially this issue, that the way that the U.S., China, and Russia basically have technical teams of hackers, not only to infiltrate other systems and other countries' defenses, but as well as ours as kind of a defense system of our systems as well. Basically, the article was saying is that with in this new age where everything is linked and everything is digital, you almost need an army of people to protect your systems, and at the same time an army to go and launch attacks if your systems are attacked. And so immediately what I thought was that's what it was. It was some type of coordinated attack on our systems. It could be something unsophisticated. It could have been a government. It could have been a variety of things that I don't think at this point we know what it was. But clearly, I think, you know, most people have begun to believe that theory, that it was something, there was something more at play yesterday than just a random sort of series of events that occurred. And I think that's something that we're going to have to be dealing with, not only today, but here going into the future. I think these are real issues that all Americans should be concerned about, because it's really, it's not only our defenses, but it could be the next attack could be on the electricity grid. It could be on the power grid. There's a variety of ways that our country is vulnerable. And I just think this is kind of the first foray to see how alert and how ready we are for any future attacks.
So there's two things I want to talk about. One is from a proactive standpoint, and for our listeners, what do we do? Let's talk about what do we do if, you know, if yesterday had, let's say, shut down the banking, had shut down, and it wasn't a one-hour shutdown, it was something much more drastic, or had shut down our electrical grids, what do we do? Is it paranoid to have some level of preparedness? Is it paranoid to have cash around in case the ATMs don't work? Is it paranoia? You know, in the past, say 20 years ago, if somebody was a prepper, if somebody hoarded, or maybe that's not the actual word you should use, because if you're prepping, you're not necessarily hoarding, you're stockpiling for the purpose of self-preservation and hopefully preservation of your neighbors or your family or whoever else you can afford to help. You were seen as like the local or the neighborhood nut. Today, I don't think it's unrealistic or I actually think it's irresponsible not to prepare in any way that you can. Now, admittedly, Steve, everybody can't prepare to the same level. I can't prepare to the level Donald Trump does, and someone living in the ghetto in North Philadelphia can't compare to the level that I can. However, everyone, to some extent, can think through their living situation, the logistics of how they get from point A to point B in their daily lives, what their water supply is, what their staple food supply is, even if it's nothing more than 20 jars of peanut butter. If there's no food on the shelves in the supermarket and you've got 10 packages of crackers and 10 jars of peanut butter and water, you might not be the happiest critter going for the next 2 weeks, but you'd be somebody getting nourishment, fluid, protein, and some carbohydrate. I mean, I just think that it's – and then, of course, there are people who are also prepared by – you know, weapon sales in the last month went through the roof again since we've had these illegal immigrant assaults and murders happening. There are people who also prepare with arms. They prepare to be able to physically defend themselves if someone were to encroach upon their property or their home or their person. So I don't think it's crazy anymore to talk out loud and encourage people to the extent that you can keep some cash at hand, do it. To the extent that you can keep some staple food at hand, do it. To the extent if you're so inclined and you have a weapon and you have a license to have that weapon, you know how to use it. Don't just have purchased it and have it laying in a cabinet or locked somewhere where if you did need it, you basically would be starting from scratch and not remembering whatever it was you did to get your license. I just think that yesterday was a shot across the bow and needs to be a wake-up call for our listeners and for whoever they want to share the information with, that it is far from being crazy. It's more like being totally responsible, I think, to be prepared. Do you, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, yeah,
absolutely. I think the nature of our society today and the way that we live and the way that we are in many ways a lot more vulnerable to a lot of different shocks that I would say before that we were not, I think it just makes good sense. I mean, we're seeing something, you know, really interesting right now. Just, you know, for example, the situation in Greece, which is, you know, it's not unlike, it's not an unlikely scenario that could take place in many different countries. And if you look at what's happening there, essentially you've had a shutdown of the system. The banks are no longer dispensing cash. There's an element of what cash are they going to be able to use. They're limited in terms of the amount of cash that they can take out. The stores don't know whether they should be accepting credit cards or not, the payments, because they don't know if the payments are going to be honored. So essentially, you've gone in a small sample. You've gone to a country like Greece, and they're basically demanding cash for their transactions that they're receiving. And I think that's a reasonable response. I think most Americans always kind of look at these scenarios and say, you know, that's just Greece. That can't happen here. That's just another country. That those things don't happen here. Well, the reality is they happen everywhere. I mean, human nature is what it is. We're all humans, and we're all afflicted by the same picadillos that every other human is afflicted with. And a lot of people can argue is that, you know, our economic situation is no different than Greece's. The only difference is really that we're just a reserve currency. But if you look back on, say, for example, 2008, there was a real concern that the whole banking system was ready to collapse. And, you know, we would have had something where we would have had a cash society for about 30, 60 days as we had a reset. So, no, I don't think it's a ridiculous thing to be prepared for things like that. The other point that I think that was interesting to me was, I don't know if you saw this, but like 3 months ago, there was a problem with the welfare system. I think it's called TBT or EBT systems. The cards just get paid electronically, and I forget which city that it happened to, but there was a delay in the payment of the EBT cards, which is basically how many of the lower class and poor communities get paid so they can go out and turn buy food. Well, they ransacked the Walmart within 24 hours, and they completely stole the store. So people will do desperate things and do crazy things to survive. So to the extent that you can be prepared for that, yeah, I think that's a good thing, Carol.
Well, when you talk about people thinking that it can't happen here, that's always been, I think, most of the world's troubles. Americans have felt it couldn't happen here because we've always been a blessed nation of sorts, and we've always been ahead of the curve, and we've had a stable government for a very long time, and coups were not part of our history, and riots and revolution, other than our original revolution, were not part of our history, with the Civil War being the one exception. And so I think that the mindset that it can't happen here is a dangerous mindset. And by example, I would say this. You know, we read every day in the news that ISIS goes into these countries and destroys the churches and destroys the historical monuments and destroys history, artifacts, you know, because they have a narrative. And that narrative is radical Islam, and anything that doesn't comport with that, they simply demolish and destroy. And it seems like something that could never happen here, right? However, I was thinking today, you know, now the Confederate flag is a no-no. And so it isn't just that it can't fly on the State House. You're a bigot if it's on your car. You're a bigot if it's on your lawn. They want to abolish, they actually want to take down certain monuments. There's a movement to rename the Jefferson Monument. They want to dig up the bodies of one or two Civil War generals that are buried in the South. I mean, think about this. You would think this couldn't happen in America. All this is political correctness taken to its absolute extreme. And while no one's beheading anyone else here yet, that notion, just like the Washington Redskins, the notion that you can intimidate someone who believes something different than you, and you can intimidate them to the point where you can either bankrupt them, or you can terrify them or terrorize them, like a baker who won't bake a cake for a gay couple, even though he sold gay people pastry before and just simply didn't want to participate in the wedding, where you can absolutely turn these people into outcasts and make them pariahs. And I mean, Donald Trump is another good example of that happening now. He just happens to be powerful enough and rich enough in the moment to withstand the onslaught. I'm not sure that it isn't, not only can it happen here, I think, Steve, it's already happening here. And the slope we've gone down with this Confederate flag issue and with the bakers and the florists who don't want to participate in gay weddings, I think that slope, that or the minister, the judge, the black judge who yesterday or the day before stepped down and recused himself from marrying a lesbian couple that had come to the courtroom to be married. The couple was married anyway by another judge who stepped in. And recusal has been an age-old, time-honored option for judges who felt they either had a bias or they had a conflict. Judges recuse themselves all the time. Now there's an outcry for this judge to be disbarred and thrown off the bench. This is witch hunting in its worst form. And I think we are dangerously asleep around what we're permitting to have done. I don't know what your thoughts are on this, Steve. You and I haven't actually spoken about this, but is any of this ringing true for you?
Yeah, these are all things that, you know, if you pick up any good science fiction book or pick up any book on George Orwell or even, you know, the writings of Noam Chomsky, they talk about this at length. That, you know, these are all things that are elements of how you destroy the past and how you destroy culture. I mean, words, and the definition of words are really important things. The extent you can change the definition and the meaning of the words is the ability to change and move the culture and move the direction of the culture in the ways that you want. And the same way with, as you're saying, symbols and images. I mean, the Confederate flag all of a sudden has become a symbol for racism. I mean, where does that come up? I mean, for the most part, if you would ask, the history of the Confederate flag is one of oppression, fighting the oppressive nature of what the North was trying to do with the South in terms of economic imposition of what they were trying to do. So it has a different meaning and a different connotation for people of the South. Again, it's the liberal progressive movement that are very astute at what they're trying to do. They're trying to destroy the images, the definitions of words, and change what things mean to get the culture to move in a direction that I think most Americans are not aware of. And I would say on top of that, you know, there's been, you know, in the last 2 months, I don't know if you've seen this, Carol, but there's been a lot of kind of, you know, smart commentators going out to the beaches and asking really basic questions. What does July 4th mean to you? When was it? Who was it? Just basic questions about, you know, the definitions of what our history is. And there's, I mean, to a T, most of these people cannot even understand what the definition of July 4th is, what it means. And so I think that the attack has been twofold. Number one is removing the last vestiges of what I'd call American, you know, the history of America. And the second part has been through the education system, is people don't even know what the history is. And once you can destroy both those things, then, you know, really anything kind of goes at that point. I think that's the issue that we're getting close to now, Carol. What do you think?
I heard one of those interviews, and I heard a girl who had just graduated high school, literally like 3 days before, interviewed and asked when the Declaration of Independence was signed, and she said 1930. And it's laughable and it's deeply disturbing, right? Because if you can take away a person's history, I mean, think about this. Isn't that what the slave traders tried to do to the slaves? They tore them out of their culture. They transported them physically out of their land. They cut off their access to their culture. They wouldn't allow them to be taught how to read. The purpose of keeping them enslaved was to keep them ignorant of their own prideful, righteous pride in their own heritage, and to keep them ignorant of what their potential rights were. And so this is what happens when there are certain things you always do in human history when you want to subjugate a population. You take away the weapons, you take away the guns first, you marginalize certain parts of society and blame them for the rest of society's woes. You limit access to information and you try to cut people off from their history, from anything that will make them prideful in themselves and have them feel they have value. And actually, Michelle Obama and Barack Obama were very clear about this going into the 2008 election. She said, Barack knows we're going to have to change our culture. We're going to have to change our traditions. We're going to have to change our history. Well, you don't change your history. You may be examine it more closely. You may fill in blanks that you left unfilled, but you don't change your history and you don't change your traditions. And if you do, you certainly don't have that done by the federal government. You may have it done by your family. And speaking of family, Steve, because we've got 7 minutes left, and there's one other thing I want to cover for people, because I think for most of the listeners, if not all, this will be pretty shocking, and that is, you know, when Obamacare was being debated and Sarah Palin made those statements about death panels, and everybody made her crazy and said she was nuts, right? And in fact, that aspect of Obamacare was eliminated because they just didn't want the problem to obstruct it. They were going to have enough trouble already. Well, what has now happened is Obamacare has now authorized Medicare. Now, Medicare takes care of 80% of the people, you know, over the age of 65, I guess it is. Medicare is now empowered and authorized, and they have coded, they are coding their billing procedures to pay doctors, physician assistants, and nurses to have end-of-life discussions with patients. They are paid each time they have an end-of-life discussion, and there's no limit on how many end-of-life discussions they can have. So you can have an 80-year-old laying in a bed in a hospital, maybe hooked up to something or other, but cognizant, fully conscious, fully aware, and the doctor can come in and say, you know, Sam, you're 85, and have you thought about, you know, how long you might want to lay here, and the odds of you going home aren't good. And regardless of what the family may want, the doctor and the nurse and the practitioner have the right under the, they don't have the right, they have the obligation under Medicare. And here's why I say it's an under Obamacare and Medicare, and here's why I say it's an obligation. I listened to a cardiac surgeon today who said there are actually bonus incentives built into the Medicare billing to have those conversations. There is a question on the end of the, when the doctor has to fill in all of his billing codes, there are questions that ask the doctors, did you do X, did you do Y, before you proceeded with a certain procedure. The cardiac surgeon said, there is a question, did you have end-of-life discussions with this patient, and how many did you have? And based on how many you had, you get a greater percentage of your submission paid. That is a death.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that, for your submission paid? I don't understand that.
You will get a greater return. You know, Medicare pays a portion of what the doctor bills. And they pay it based on a percentage. So a doc, you know, what you'd ever noticed that, like I just had an automobile accident last year. I was hit rear-ended, and my billing was $22,000 for the emergency ward and the subsequent medical treatment that I received. But Medicare only paid $3,700. That's all they pay. And that's all the hospital's going to get is the $3,700 that Medicare paid on those charges. Well, when you submit those charges, they pay based on you have to have fulfilled certain treatment criteria, and the amount you get paid is based on whether or not you fulfilled your treatment criteria. With these end-of-life discussions, based on how many you've had, you will get a greater payment. The doctor will get a greater payment from Medicare. It will be increased. The amount he receives on a procedure, on his submissions on that patient, if he has had end-of-life discussions, and the more he has, the more he receives in return on his submissions. Huh. So they're going to encourage doctors with the elderly why would you need an end-of-life discussion? That's between you and your lawyer or you and your kid or you and your spouse. That's not between you and your doctor. It's not the doctor's place to have an end-of-life discussion with a patient, and it's certainly not a case to have several of them or to be encouraged to have several, because that's just pressure. That's just harassment, and that's just encouraging someone to die when what we're supposed to do is encourage people to get well and get out of the hospital. But they want those beds. They want those beds, and they don't want to spend money keeping the elderly alive because it's not cost effective.
Oh, yeah, that's coming. I mean, people, you know, never didn't believe it or didn't want to believe it, but that's essentially that's the cost savings. If you think about it, right? There's
correct.
Yeah, I forget the numbers, but you know, it's something ridiculous. Like, you know, in a lifetime, you'll you know, if you spend, we'll just say 100% of your medical costs over the course of your life, it's like something like 85% is the last year of your life trying to save that person. So, you know, from a strict monetary sense, it makes sense that not to provide the service because that's when most of the money gets spent. So it's if you look at it from a straight economic situation, it makes obvious sense that's what they would have to do. You know, the reality is, you know, people couldn't believe it. They couldn't understand, and they couldn't possibly believe that the government would actually do this to them. But, yes, that is going to happen.
Well, I find it just incredibly – we got 2 minutes left. I find it incredibly disgusting, actually. I mean, if I had a 90-year-old mother who fell and broke her hip. She had a hip surgery. They put a pin in. You know, many people decline after that. My mother rallied, and she was off her crutches, off her walker, and she lived 3.5 more years and lived without pain and lived a good 3.5 years. And I had some great moments with her in those 3.5 years. And the thought that she would have been allowed to die when she fell and broke her hip is appalling to me. They don't get to make those decisions, and yet they will in our future. And so many of us who are boomers will find ourselves the very first guinea pigs of this new system that is the government saying how much time you have left to live. I always thought that was up to God, or you and your God, or you and your family and your God. I never thought it would be a decision anyone would want the federal government to make. So, unfortunately, we're out of time, Steve. Thank everyone, as always, we do. Steve and I are very grateful for your time. We know it's precious. We're thrilled that you come here to listen to Above the Fray, that you spread the word on Above the Fray. We're here to empower you. I'm Carol Gold.
I'm Steve Clark.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Above the Fray with Carol Gold and Steve Clark, from politics to the divine. Thanks for being a part of a new way to see the world. Visit our website at AboveTheFrayPodcast.com and like us on our Facebook fan page, Facebook.com/AboveTheFrayPodcast. This has been Carol Gold and Steve Clark, taking you always above the fray.